If you are a Black Hat hacker, or perhaps you were one and you're just not admitting to it, and you might have been considering targets of opportunities, a service provider network might be a very interesting place to go. The infrastructure is critical for commerce and government operations. The data carried is always interesting and potentially quite valuable. And indeed, we do know that carrier networks are highly targeted, as we get to see it so often. In this sponsored show with Cisco Systems, we are going to discuss how to think deeply about security on mission-critical networks, protecting network devices that are not behind the firewall, but open in the open network where everybody can reach it, making certain that the network operating system is running exactly the code that we think it is and that we intended it to run, and that the devices are ones we know and can trust. We put them there. Are they the ones in there? And then once we've secured those devices and the network overall, how can we use it as a platform to deliver additional security services? So this is below the line, on the line, and above the line. And we're going to try and cover all that from a security perspective on iOS XR. Our guests today are Dan Backman and Karthik Sivakumar of Cisco. Dan is the technical marketing engineer on the service provider team, and Karthik is a security architect for the iOS XR engineering team. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. Let's kick off straight into the conversation. Operators need to trust their infrastructure. Is this a bigger deal for service providers than in the enterprise? And if so, what's sort of the difference there?
Absolutely. So I've actually spent time on both sides of the house. And what's kind of interesting about enterprise versus service provider is just looking at what the exposure is. In the enterprise, if you think about it, most of your network is sitting behind a firewall. So you actually have this idea of a trusted, secure network. If you're a service provider, you are the internet core. Mm-hmm. Every device you have is by definition running outside of a firewall. And that really is one of the toughest things about running the service provider network and hardening not only the systems, but the operational model around that as well.
So things behind the firewall have got some protection at least, or protection from obvious sorts of threats.
Absolutely. I mean, so think about it. If you have an internal router, so let's say you're an enterprise running a data center. If you have an internal router, if you want to attack the operating system of that router, you have to be inside the network. Mm. There's a firewall that's literally stopping somebody from the outside from getting in.
So that's attack services, and that reduces the number of actors that can get to you. They have to get inside the perimeter physically or logically in some way. And what about traffic? I mean, what's the inside the enterprise, the traffic's probably better from the point of view that it's target rich, but service providers have just got scale as well.
Well, the biggest problem for a service provider is that it's all bulk traffic. And in almost every case, they're acting as a common carrier. So their job is to literally push packets, regardless of what they are. So the question is, what happens when some of that traffic on the network is malicious? That's really the security concern of the provider. And it means a couple things. What if that malicious traffic is targeted at your devices, if they're trying to compromise the actual devices of the network? What if some of that traffic is malicious in that it's literally just trying to overrun the bandwidth in a denial of service attack?
Yeah.
Or what happens if that traffic is actually aimed at the customers of that network?
So the service provider network has unique threats, or threats that are specific to that infrastructure, perhaps separate from where other routers might be deployed.
Absolutely. But it's also a unique role. So if you think about an enterprise network, if something happens to an enterprise network, by definition, it tends to affect that enterprise. If you're a carrier network, let's say you're a national carrier, you basically are the critical infrastructure for that company. Mm-hmm. One of the customers we talked to that's a major national carrier basically had the realization that our network and the health of our network is literally the health of that country's economy.
So what we need to do there is, just to try and break that down into activities, is that holding the management plane and the control plane stable? Is that or is it about managing the data plane? So do I need to be securing things like routing protocols or SSH, or do I need to be securing the data plane? Can I send a malformed packet through the data plane that causes the router to cough up some data or something?
Well, unfortunately, the answer is it's all of those. But if you look at it from the bottom up, as a network engineer, you start to think about, how do I protect the control plane? How do I provide services that can provide protection for my customers? How do I start to actually do data plane protection? All of these things are things you have to configure. But if you look at it top down, it's even a bigger question. How do you establish a trusted network? So if you're a carrier, you actually have to build this as a trusted network, and you have to ask lots of pretty scary questions. It's not just a question of, did you configure the router correctly? you have routers deployed in locations around your area, and you need to know, for instance, is that actually your router? Has somebody modified that? The threats that you're dealing with as a carrier are at a different level of escalation than what you would have at a customer. You have to worry about nation state threats.
So we've heard a lot about carriers going into shared facilities, and they may have meet me rooms in colos, for example, or a lot of the telcos are starting to share POPs, where each carrier gets a rack and they do their own thing inside of that rack. And those, while inside of that room, it's physically secure, like access to inside the room is secured, there are other people getting in there that are not necessarily belonging to your organization that you can control. And this physical security or physical hardware security is becoming a thing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, so if you think about trust, this is something that people have been looking at for quite a while in the security side, and you tend to think of this as highly secured systems like HSMs or highly secured services. But think about the network infrastructure itself. It is fundamentally a computer running an operating system with a set of specialized hardware. How do you know that that is actually running exactly the software that you expect it to do? How do you know that it's actually performing exactly the way you would expect it to behave? These are the problems you have to start thinking about, especially in shared areas. And the threat surface of a network device is not just the actual operating system, but it's also the hardware as well.
Mm. And so you're alluding to, well, we've seen in the past, we've seen nation state actors actually compromise the hardware by putting something inside the box. But you're also talking about things like gray market. Maybe somebody's come in and replaced the router with a different product or changeover or something like that, or is that just getting too weird?
Well, it sounds weird, but these are actually the types of things you'd have to think about. So if we peel this back, if you're a provider and you're running a national backbone, you almost have to ask the question of who are the threats and what are they trying to do? Mm. So if you put your slightly darker colored hat on and start thinking as an attacker, what would you do if you actually had the ability to affect a backbone network? Like, what are the attacks that you could actually run?
So we talked about how we need to get things secure. What is it? What are the sort of threats that we need to be worrying about if we're concerned about the physical and logical security of the device? Where do we need to be?
So if you're thinking about security at a provider level, you really have to dial up the paranoia level a little bit. Start thinking about who your adversaries really are. It could be a script kiddie who is exercising some vulnerability, trying to get access to a router and cause mischief, or it could be an actual nation state that is trying to compromise your network. And you have to start thinking about what is the reward for somebody attacking a network to understand just how much you have to think about trust and integrity. Like, if you're an attacker, if you owned a router and a national backbone, what could you do?
Mm.
Like, just think of the myriad things that you could have fun with or start to cause some real trouble.
And well, I think there's a couple of things there, because obviously if you can take over one, you can actually take over, well, hundreds potentially of routers if you had the right sort of attack. And it can happen those sorts of threats happen at different levels, physical as well as software.
Exactly. And because if you think of how many other security controls are actually rooted in trust to the network, once you can compromise the network itself, you have the ability to affect so many other things and create second order effects you weren't thinking about. The easiest thing to think about is what happens if somebody gets access to your router and does a write erase and a reboot. Mm. That's happened. It has happened in production networks before, and it's happened in carrier networks. But that's the obvious attack. The ones you need to worry about are the ones that are less obvious. If you're trying to do surveillance, wouldn't it be really useful to have control over a network and redirect traffic in a path where it could pass through deep packet inspection?
Yep.
And you can start to see what people are doing?
So you could capture the traffic, maybe encapsulate in a tunnel, send it off to somewhere and then send it back when you've done whatever it is you want to do.
Exactly.
In man in the middle or intercept traffic interception.
Right. And then the question is, could you even detect it? Because that actually happens all the time. Mm. Think about cloud-based DDoS prevention services. In many cases, what it will actually do is route traffic through a tunnel through a cloud scrubbing center.
Mm-hmm.
So that type of transit already happens on backbone. So the question is, if that happened, how quickly could you detect it? And if the attackers actually had a good foothold in the devices, how well could they cover their tracks?
Dan, just one point of clarification here. This is not just, you know, rabid paranoia. These are things that happen. We know that there have been manufacturing supply chain compromises that have happened and so on. In other words, this is a real threat that we actually need to think about, not just be like, again, not just rabid paranoia.
Absolutely. So, I mean, the vectors that people have used to actually compromise the systems already exist. And what you see is a reaction to some of these vectors. We'll talk more about what Cisco is doing to prevent things like supply chain attacks and guarantee device integrity. And we've also seen other attacks, even at the control plane layer. We've already witnessed attacks where traffic was rerouted through another continent for surveillance. And that was done through a BGP attack. So if you think you're a third part or third tier carrier and you're not a target, well, maybe you might be the target for compromise so that you can inject BGP information from that site.
Mm. So it's not as...
Yeah, and there's man-in-the-middle attacks. I mean, if you control the network, if you're querying DNS on Google's 8888 or 8844, you think you're going to Google. But if you control the network, you can inject an Anycast and actually hijack that DNS traffic.
Mm-hmm. So how do we solve that? What's the solution to that? Up until now, there's really not been much that we could do except to try and make sure that we're buying genuine hardware or check that we're having certified capabilities. How do we solve that going forward?
Well, it's ultimately a defense in depth discussion. And some of these answers are operational. There's obvious operational things you have to do. You have to secure the systems. You have to implement good operational practices, good key management, good authentication, AAA, and good logging. The things you already know how to do. Mm-hmm. But there's some of the questions that have been scary and a little bit harder to answer, which is really gets to be around trust. Mm-hmm. If you think about what you do with the router, how much of your interaction with the router is just configuration? You're telling the router to do something, you expect it to do something, you configure AAA, you configure user accounts, and you're basically trusting that the router is implementing that configuration correctly.
Yes.
How do you know that that router is actually doing what you told it to do? That's where the trust question.
Well, there's an implied sense of trust in that I bought this from the vendor through so whatever my supply chain is, and that it's going to behave like the book says it's going to behave. But right, that's, you know, having that... you know, warm, fuzzy feeling that that's how it's going to be is different from actually being able to prove that the operating system is the operating system you think you have, or that the hardware is the hardware that it purports to be. There's no, you know, by default, there's nothing there that tells you that. So, well, I guess that's what we're talking about, Dan, that things can be different.
Exactly. So you're hitting the nail on the head. So if we talk about carrier and provider security, a lot of this really is about trust. How do you establish and maintain trust? And if you put your security hat on, this should be a familiar discussion. If you have a critical server that you want to protect, you need to be able to establish and maintain trust on that system. The same methodology actually applies in the network layer. Mm. And when you start thinking about devices now that have this level of critical importance, that also, by the way, are by definition deployed in distributed environments, in many cases where you don't trust. I mean, a shared peering location is one thing where you could potentially have other carriers have access to it. But now start thinking about the carriers who run radio access networks for mobile towers. You may have an access router sitting in somebody's basement attached to a local tower and local radio.
All those towers are often shared facilities now. Several telcos share the towers to put their equipment in it too. Different countries have different situations and different telcos have different situations. But yes, that's what happens, isn't it?
Absolutely. And that's also part of the provider network. So the question is, it's not just in the core where you normally think of these types of threats. It's also way out at the edge as well, where you have to establish and maintain trust. And because it's remote, now the question of, is this the device that you think it is? Is it actually your device, or is it something pretending to be your device? These are the questions that become very, very interesting, especially for those types of deployments.
Now, Dan, this reminds me of a company that Cisco bought, actually, Skyport Systems, where so this is more server and VM-related infrastructure, but, you know, establishing a chain of trust for the hardware and then the different processes that spin up on the box and, you know, and so on. It sounds like we're going down that sort of a road, only in a router iOS XR context. Am I close?
It certainly sounds like a familiar story, and it really is trying to solve the problem of what do you do with establishing and maintaining trust. And from a security point of view, it's really sort of the same problem space, but in this case, it's more focused directly on network infrastructure. And as you're clearly pointing out, I may be familiar with that story from Skyport. Because,
I thought you might be, yeah. From there. So we've got hardware and we've got software, which to me feel like similar, but maybe kind of different things. How do I know, first of all, that the box I get, the router, is a router that hasn't been tampered with, that I can trust it?
So let's actually start there, because I think that's a great discussion. I also want to bring Karthik into this discussion as well, because he can give us the insight from the actual engineering side. Karthik is our security architect for iOS XR. So I know he's thinking about a lot of these problems literally on a daily basis. So if we start thinking about establishing trust, we actually have to ask one interesting question, is how do you trust anything that's software? So one of the toughest things about software is if you compromise software, it can be programmed to lie to you.
Maybe the best thing we can do is to, you know, today when you download something from GitHub, you just have to trust the source, or maybe you can fingerprint it at best, but really that's about it.
Well, but the fingerprinting and the code signing is really the key for how do you know that you can trust a specific set of code. Mm-hmm. So right now, if I download something for my Mac, if I want to install that software, if I'm going to put my security hat on, I will go download the software. And before I install it, before I type an administrative password to install that, I'm going to take a SHA-SUM locally of that file that I downloaded and then go to the site and compare. First of all, does that SHA-SUM match? Did I download the file that I thought I did? Mm. And then some software distribution can go even further and say, well, how do you know that the hash that was posted is correct? You can then go ahead and sign that. Yes. With something that can be cryptographically traced back to the original source. So that's a way that you can actually know that you have the right software.
Yes.
But it actually goes a little further than that.
Okay. I was going to say, vendor signed software has absolutely been a revolution in operating systems. Obviously, we've seen, you know, Microsoft, Apple, and so forth delivering signed updates, and that's revolutionized the delivery of software and our ability to trust over-the-air updates. And I think we've seen plenty of proof that works as a general idea.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd like to bring Karthik into this discussion too, because first of all, Karthik is much more intelligent on cryptography than I am and can definitely describe this a lot better than I can. But in general, when you start thinking about this problem of trust, as a security architect, Karthik, how do you think about this problem in terms of how do we know that this is a device you can trust, this is running the software that you can trust, just from an engineering point of view?
So I think this is absolutely a key point. And as Dan mentioned, a lot of us in engineering spend a lot of time just worrying about this. And this is not even paranoia. I mean, we really need to figure this out. So we started with the absolute basics. Define what is a Cisco router. Right? How do you exactly say that something is a Cisco router? What is it about a Cisco router that can tell you that this is a Cisco router, right? And then we would have to build up the layers from there. So if you look at it, every Cisco router needs to be able to identify itself. There are, you know, cryptographic means to identify yourself. You might have a serial number backed up by a signature that's in a root of trust somewhere. And then there's, of course, the public key infrastructure that's involved. There's a private key that we take a lot of pains to safeguard in our infrastructure. And then the equivalent public certificate for that is used to subsequently establish the chain of trust with all of the devices and so on. So basically, we have to first start with defining what is a Cisco router, right? And then we build up right from there.
Karthik, if during the manufacturing process, if that router was assembled or a line card was assembled or something with a BIOS or some add-on that you could put on that board that would be able to inject code, that wouldn't be cryptographically signed. It wouldn't participate properly in the trust chain and should be able to be flagged. Is that how we're saying we're being protected here?
That's exactly right. So when a Cisco device is manufactured, at that point we have a root of trust in there. It's just a chip there that effectively encodes the serial number. It's called a SUDI, a secure unique device identifier, which is again a standard. It is part of the IEEE 802.1AR standard, and we take that secure identifier there. It's inserted into the device at manufacturing, and then there are also Cisco public certificates that are then inserted into the devices how do I root of trust at the time of manufacturing? And these then form the layers which then subsequently authenticate every layer of the boot up process. So in the example that you mentioned, we start off with the hardware root of trust that verifies the BIOS, the BIOS verifies the bootloader verifies the kernel, and so on. So which is the secure boot process that Cisco devices go through. And this secure boot process effectively allows you to verify that, as a very first step, the identity of the device, the SUDI, lets you identify the device as a Cisco device. And then the whole boot up process allows you to identify that you're running a verified Cisco image, that nobody was able to inject something in this boot up process to be able to control the device. It's something that you could potentially, I think what we would call it is a first instruction integrity. Effectively, you know what the first instruction is that's going to be executed on this device. And then that lets you control what the subsequent instructions are going to look like. And then that gives you the absolute chain of trust for you to be able to establish the trust of the entire software itself.
And the chain of trust is important because why?
Well, let's take a look at what problem this actually solves. Yep. So I do security for a living, and let me tell you, when you get into details of chain of trust, this makes your head hurt. I spent a couple days with Karthik and some of the key crypto folks over in our RTP office last week, and my brain still hurts from all the information that we walked through in terms of how this works and sort of what's hard about doing this.
Yeah.
I think there's a key takeaway here is that there's a reason for doing this chain of trust. And when we start talking about chain of trust, I mean, I don't know about you, but my eyes would glaze over pretty quick too when we start talking about this. Let's talk about why this matters. So the problem is that software can always be compromised from underneath. So for instance, if you download a piece of code from the internet, mm-hmm. and you run that as an application on your Mac, you're kind of automatically and implicitly trusting that your OS is okay, and you're just worried about that one application. Then you start asking questions, well, how do I know that I can trust the operating system? How do I know that the operating system wasn't compromised? And the state of attacks today, if you're a motivated attacker with real resources, you're not thinking about how do I break into an OS to do something. You start thinking about how do I break the boot process so that I can install malicious code underneath the OS so that even if you reboot the box, it comes back owned.
Yep. Yep.
That's the threat surface. That's the thing you have to worry about these systems.
It happens at multiple levels too, because it's not only the software image, it's also the firmware. So really, we actually need some sort of hardware to validate that the firmware is secure, that the FPGA and the CPUs are all valid. There needs to be something, if you want to have this complete chain of trust from manufacture to end of life cycle, that you need some sort of hardware in the box to say, box hasn't been tampered with, each of the chips has got a key or something, and the software's got a key, and I can validate all of those, surely?
Absolutely. So think of this like a Russian doll. That's how you want to think about it. And you hit the nail on the head. So if you start thinking about, can I trust the config and the protocols running on a router? Then you start asking, well, can I trust the OS? How do I know I can trust that? Then you ask questions, how do I trust the firmware? Mm-hmm. And then you start getting all the way down to hardware.
So that means you could put, I think I can just sort of imagine here, there's a hardware module in there that's built at factory. And where the vendor, where Cisco says this is a root of trust and it's controlled right at the point of manufacture. And then you can use that to countersign everything else around it. Is that where we're headed?
So that's something that's already built into Cisco routers. So there's
What's
something
called?
It's called a TAM. And this trust anchor module is really, it's a combination of hardware and software, but there is hardware underneath it. And this whole subsystem is really designed to solve a couple problems. So number one, how do you establish identity and also authenticity of this box from a hardware layer, which means that you have to bake in the check for the actual cryptographic check of each piece of code that executes all the way down to hardware, so that you'd actually have to modify the hardware in order to be able to break that. And the hardware itself is built so that it's anti-tamper. That's the level that you have to go down. Once you have the ability to do that, now you can create the secure boot chain, which basically says if at any point in that chain you try to run code that has not been signed and authorized, it literally stops it from running.
Mm. This would also work for counterfeit equipment too, right? We've had troubles where counterfeit equipment got into the supply chain and there was problems. It wasn't up to the same level of quality. Failures were higher. Software wouldn't execute properly. This would also attack that risk to businesses. People who are betting their businesses on Cisco don't want to have counterfeit gear, right?
Absolutely. So let's talk about the questions that this really solves, because ultimately security is about being able to answer simple questions with effective technology. So there's a couple simple questions you want to be able to answer if you're going to establish a trusted system. Number one, how do I know I can trust the integrity of this system? How do I know this is the hardware that I purchased? How do I know that this is the software that I intend to run? And that's really what the secure boot process is. And then there's another set of questions, which is how do I know that this is mine? How do I know that this is my ASR 9000 and not somebody else's that they swapped in?
Yep.
So these are all functions that are built inside of this Trust Anchor module. And I think we should touch on this a little bit, because one of the key things here is the idea of secure boot is not unique to Cisco. Secure boot is implemented on other platforms, but there's some interesting caveats to this. So if you have a server, let's say you have a Windows server, maybe it's running Active Directory, and you want to make sure that you can actually trust you're running an authorized copy of Windows and it hasn't been modified. There is something called Secure Boot that you can run there. But one of the things that we found is that doesn't actually go far enough.
Mm-hmm.
So Karthik, if we start looking at this, like, there is something for UEFI Secure Boot that exists that allows you to sort of validate the operating system and the boot chain. What's different about the problem that we had to solve on the iOS side versus what can be done in a generic x86 processor?
So typically, as Dan was talking about, typically on a Windows server, we have what is called a UEFI secure boot. The UEFI secure boot effectively starts at the BIOS. The BIOS verifies, has a set of keys and a chain of trust, and then it verifies the bootloader. The bootloader verifies the kernel, or in the case of Windows, it basically verifies the Windows kernel and so on up the chain.
Mm-hmm.
But who verifies the BIOS itself? Right. In a typical server system that you, let's say your laptop or just a regular server system that you buy, if the root of trust is your BIOS, but BIOS itself is a firmware, how do you verify that the firmware, that BIOS is a valid BIOS and has not been tampered with? I think that's a very key question for us to answer. Mm-hmm. And at Cisco, we really didn't want to, that's not the level of security that we are happy with. Right. So because that's an area that still is something that can be tampered with, and you break the chain of trust if you can just tamper the BIOS at that point.
Right.
Which is when we went back and we added the TAMP module that Dan is talking about.
That's the trust anchor module. That's what TAMP
exactly.
Trust anchor module.
Exactly.
Right.
Trust anchor module. The trust anchor module is a specific hardware that is built. And its sole purpose is to store cryptographic material. One is the identity. The second is the certificates required to then verify the BIOS itself.
Right.
And the Trust Anchor module is a read-only module. It's tamper-proof module. So which means that there is no way to go and modify the firmware in the Trust Anchor module to be able to do something there, to be able to tamper it there. So that hardware device then provides you the strong root of trust that enables you to trust the BIOS first.
Right.
And then build the chain of trust from there. And now this provides you a non-tamperable chain of trust starting from that single hardware module.
Yes, so right at the factory, there's a root of trust further back in the factory when the TAM is actually made in a highly secure manufacturing facility, just to try and put this chain of trust down for people who aren't familiar with it, just expand that a little. So right back at the beginning, then a secure manufacturing facility, Cisco's building these TAM chips, trust anchor chips, and then they're actually then brought in a secure way into the manufacturing process, and they have hardwired crypto certificates in them. And that then forms the root of trust for the device upwards from the device. So each device now has a cryptographic chip with a key and various mechanisms on it, and I can now use that key to verify whether the BIOS is valid and the firmware is cryptographically secured, hasn't been tampered with, and the image that's running on it, and so forth and so on. I can actually validate even the chips in the box based around that root of trust. Is that how it works? Did I get that right?
That's exactly how it works, actually. So the key part is to be able to start at the manufacturing, where mm-hmm. we know exactly what goes into the device itself, into the router itself. Mm-hmm. And once you're able to trust what happens in manufacturing, which is basically the trust anchor module, mm-hmm. from that point on, everything else from that point on can be trusted. So mm-hmm. so you're absolutely correct that the whole idea is to go back to manufacturing, the very basics yep. of from the foundation of the hardware itself,
yep.
and then build up from there.
And that's key, because sometimes the components are manufactured in, it's not possible to control all parts of the manufacture. That's impractical. That's right. So the way to do this is to put one part of it as a key, as a trustworthy, and the costs and the time it takes to manage that process, and then expand that right across. So what Cisco's doing is bringing that chip into all the technologies that matter. Is that's what I would imagine you're moving forward on?
That's exactly correct. Yes, that's exactly right. How we're moving forward. Yes.
And I think the one thing to add to this is, if you start looking at this, it's really solving two problems. It's creating that trust anchor, but at the same time, we're using hardware to start the secure boot process before the CPU actually comes up. That's actually the other big difference between this and existing secure boot technologies. And the reason you care about this is the types of attacks you have to think about when you're operating this type of carrier class environment is you have to start thinking about, can people compromise your firmware or your BIOS and actually compromise the boot process? This is what's called a boot kit. So this is protection that's actually built into the factory that actually starts in hardware before the operating system even attempts to load. And right. then also has this secure key store, which really solves the problem of how do you know that you can trust the actual calculations that are being run in terms of the crypto side.
So is the trust anchor just used for hardware, or can it be used for other functions? Obviously, it's used for signatures around the software update. So I know that patches to the iOS and, you know, adding. So iOS XR in particular, for example, has this loadable architecture where it uses not pluggable modules, but DLLs and components. It's Linux underneath and then above it. Now that, because it's Linux, it's open, and open can mean, from a certain perspective, risk. People can easily get in there and start to do stuff. And you want to make sure that the integrity of your Linux and the modules that are in it remain the same. So if you can sign all that software, you can use the module to validate that this is that all of that is right.
That's correct. Yes, exactly. So as you mentioned, the iOS XR software supports not only loadable modules, but it also supports RPMs as well. So you can basically bring in functionality as you need them, and you can patch your routers with RPMs as well. So what we do is we also sign the RPMs with our keys, so that at the time of installation, at the time of an RPM install, we would verify that the RPM legitimately came from Cisco, right? That we did, you know, build that RPM, we did sign the RPM, and that provides a level of trust on that software that you're installing. Yes, you're absolutely right. Yes.
So does the TAM participate in the encryption process itself? Is it actually an encryption chip, or is it just a key on board?
The TAM is not an encryption chip. It is primarily, it could in some cases do encryption, but it's also very performance. It is not exactly very performant for encryption, no. decryption functions. Mm-hmm. So typically we use it for establishing chain of trust primarily, yeah. and as a storage for the certificates and so on. And then we do the actual validations in software, because it's a lot faster at this point. So we don't use the TAM for encryption decryption functions at this time.
Yeah, so just to disambiguate this, so the TAM is actually used for multiple things. So the signature validation, think of this as the chain. You have to maintain the chain. So it's used to start this chain in hardware. And then the chain passes through microloaders, through bootloaders, through kernels into the operating system. And so that's the function of the TAM, is to start the chain. The TAM also has another function, which is the ability to securely store a key. So this is something that you might recognize from other technologies like a TPM. Now, what it does is a little bit different from sort of a standard TPM, but it gives you the ability to also now store keys that are unique to the device inside the platform. So let's look at the other question that we want to answer. So the integrity question is about that, how we route that validation. The other question we want to answer is, how do we know that this is your router and not somebody else's router? So let's say you have a router and you swap it in an RMA. It's fundamentally a new piece of hardware today. So you would take the config and then you'd put the config on the new router and it would come up and you might see that the serial number is different, but functionally it basically behaves as the same device, right? That's kind of what you would intend.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So how do you know somebody didn't do that when you weren't looking?
Today we don't. We have to maintain physical security, or we have to maintain that the software that we're the control of the software chain to make sure it's what we want. That's about it. That's about all we can do.
Exactly. And I mean, you have things like SSH keys that are built into the system that are generated unique for each one of these devices. But the problem is that ultimately those are all pieces of software that could be copied from one place to the other. The other piece inside the TAM that we alluded to earlier is this idea of a unique identity, a SUDI. And that's actually something that we're doing uniquely inside of the TAM. That's something you generally don't get even in sort of a secure boot scenario for your Active Directory server, for instance. There's not that hardware key that's unique to that one box. If you have a TPM, this is something called taking ownership, where you generate a unique key. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, that key is now encased in a piece of hardware, where even if you had physical access to the device, you can't get that private key out. So yeah, it's basically, you can think of it as sort of a public-private
key. I see what you're saying. Normally, we used to store the private key in the flash module, but the flash module is really easy to get access to via software. You can get physical access to the console port, boom, I've got your private key. We're now saying exactly. We can use the TAM for private key management for crypto routes, exactly. Say crypto routes and SSL routes.
Correct. And you use it for two things. So you normally think of this as you can start to generate keys which are rooted in that hardware root of trust, mm-hmm. so that you cannot unlock those keys in software unless you actually have that piece of hardware. That's one of the things that you can do with it.
Right.
The thing that's unique about TAM, though, is that that key is also unique to the box.
Yep.
So that every box has its own private key. That's actually burned in manufacture and it can't be changed.
Right.
And it's guaranteed inside of the anti-counterfeit portion of that chip. So with that, you do two things that are unique. You now have a private key that cannot be extracted from the piece of hardware that you can go verify remotely. You can ask it to sign something. Mm-hmm. And you know for a fact that is actually the device, and you can cryptographically prove it. What's also unique about this is that that key also has a certificate attached that's signed by Cisco. This is the really interesting anti-counterfeit part, because not only does it have a unique identity, you can trace the identity back to Cisco's CA.
Yep. And there's a couple of things out of that. One of them is around zero-touch provisioning, obviously, because now I would actually have hardware that I could validate into my SDN controller. So if I want my iOS XR to validate into my NSO instance, the NSO would be part of the Cisco cryptographic sequence and then would be able to validate that the device is part of a certified chain?
Exactly. You're hitting the nail on the head. Things like ZTP and remote provisioning, right now, just assume identity of some of the remote devices.
Well, the first time we deploy it, we assume it's the chain is safe. And then after that, maybe we can do some stuff to check it. But as we move into this more of this software-defined WAN, just plug something into the internet and it boots and then it goes through a zero-touch provisioning process, you need to have, it would be highly desirable to have control of the hardware and a validation that the box that's calling home is the box that you sent out or that you bought. And in some cases, the vendors are shipping those boxes directly to site. They're not even going through an internal review process.
Exactly. And I think this is, if I start thinking about, what we're talking about here is plumbing that's built into hardware, into the devices. And ultimately, as an operator, what you really care about is what would you do with this? And I think you're hitting the nail on the head here. It really starts to change the game for doing things like zero-touch provisioning, especially for some of the edge and access networks that really have very rapid change. You want to be able to drop ship a box, plug it in, and know when it comes up that it's your box.
Maybe and you also don't want to test it first. You don't want to take it out of its box to set it up and put a config on it. You want to just be able to take it out to site and turn it on straight out of the, you know, when it arrives from the warehouse. This idea of, you know, sending it to a processing facility to boot it up and check that it works and get a config and update, that's all yesterday's model. That's not the way service providers want to work tomorrow.
Exactly. So, and I think if we bring this sort of back to the original point, it is about trust.
Yep.
And sometimes trust means integrity of the device. Sometimes trust means identity of the device. And once you have trust, you can start to make your operations more efficient because you don't have to assume things you couldn't assume before. You don't have to pre-stage things in the same way. You can do things like rapid deployment and remote deployment and management and validation of devices, even when they're far away.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that use case I was putting at just strikes me. You know, I can just buy a device and ship it directly to the branch and plug it in directly to an internet connection, and it'll be automatically enrolled into a system. If I know that this hardware is secured from right the way back, as far back as I can go, in theory, Cisco's supply chain is safe and monitored and trusted, then I don't even have to touch that device before it goes to site. I can just set it up on site because the updates I'm going to send to it will be cryptographically signed. The device itself will validate that the updates it receives are signed, so I know it's safe to send them out. I know that the hardware that's in the device is cryptographically secure and signed. I know the boot process now has some cryptographic capabilities or some safety, security, and integrity around it. And the operating system itself, you know, we talked about that, where the DLLs and the code that's actually executing in the box, even if somebody injects something at runtime, I'm going to have the ability to maintain that root of trust all the way through.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I think we've talked quite a bit about sort of establishing the trust. There's a really good point that you're bringing up, which is how do you maintain the trust once it's up and running? One of these core devices is probably going to have an uptime in excess of multiple quarters and possibly multiple years. So how do you know that device is still trusted after it's been running for quite a while and it has been exposed outside the firewall for a significant amount of time? That's the next thing that we need to look at.
How do we know that it doesn't get compromised from the outside somehow? Sure, we know we booted it up and everything we're running was good, but something could have changed in the interim because, as you say, it's sitting outside the firewall and so on. It's certainly a target.
Absolutely. So then the next thing is, what do you look at in terms of understanding that you're maintaining this security posture? And I think there's two things to look at. One is, how do you harden the device at the operating system level first? And at the beginning of the show, you brought up an excellent point, Greg, where it's not just about remote exploits. Some of these things are DDoSes too. Mm. A valid attack on a router is just take out the control plane. If you can DOS it on port 179 and interfere with BGP, that's a really good way to cause a network reconvergence, right? So as a carrier router manufacturer, you have to think of all these things. So if we start looking at how do we actually build in these runtime protections, that's a really strong part of the other side of what Cisco's been doing to actually strengthen and maintain that trust in XR. And there's definitely some things we wanted to touch on there. So in terms of overall control plane, there's actually additional subsystems built in between the hardware and the CPU that are actually designed to protect the integrity of the routing protocols. So Karthik, should we touch a little bit on sort of what we're doing in terms of management plane protection and also protection against remote exploits inside the code as well?
Yeah, absolutely, Dan. So from the management plane protection, we have an infrastructure called LPTS, Local Packet Transport System. The key part of this is defining a rate for the control plane packets itself. So let's take BGP, which is a canonical example for pretty much everything that we want to talk about. So if you take BGP, we have two kinds of peerings or two kinds of neighbors from whom you could get BGP packets. One is a neighbor with whom you've not yet established a neighboring relationship, and another is the one that you have established a neighboring relationship with. And there can also be, you know, you just packets coming from unsolicited neighbors and unsolicited BGP speakers. So you really want to be able to control this, the rate of packets that are coming in differently for each of these peering types. So if you're getting packets from a BGP speaker that you don't know about, then we completely limit the number of packets that can get in, what type of packets can come in, and so on. And thus limiting the impact to the BGP process itself from these unknown speakers.
Karthik, that feels like control plane policing to me. Is it actually more sophisticated than what I think of as COP?
It is a little bit more than what is just COP, but I think a lot of it is just COP. In addition to that, there is some information that we, because we know the kind of packets that are coming in, and we're able to, we know the configuration of the system itself. We're able to do a little bit more, work on top of COP to be able to do this. So the LPTS system works, not just, it can even work between RP and the line cards, for instance, and so on. So it allows us a much finer control about how things work. And we can even control whether a packet goes only to the line card, or can it even be sent to the RP at all? And what kind of communications can happen between the management port on the RP and a data port on the line card. So for instance, you cannot have a packet coming in on the line card and then try to exit out of the management port, for instance, right? So some of these are definitely are all controlled by the LPTS system that we have. So that helps us limit, the kind of impact that you would have from a DDoS attack that would happen in the system itself, into the system itself. So that's the control plane side of things that Dan was talking about, that helps us limit exposure to bad actors.
Now, what about integrity of the code and the processes that are running on the box itself? Is there a way we know that nothing's changed within the NAS since we first booted it up and since runtime?
So yes, there are different technologies, especially once you start talking about Linux. There are definitely different mechanisms by which we can do this. So internally, first let's talk about the development process itself that we go through. So security is a lot about education of the developers. It's a lot about education of the testers as well. So we want to talk to the developers about what kind of coding constructs they want to follow and so on. But then there is a catch here. We don't want BGP developers, for instance, to be thinking too much about the security aspects of things and then having to worry about it and then not being able to deliver more of the BGP such features. Mm-hmm. So what we do is we have a common infrastructure that encapsulates a lot of the bad programming practices, let's say. For instance, typically you see buffer overflows in memory copies and string copies and so on. So we have our own versions of some of these that are centrally controlled. And any program that directly, that uses these internal APIs automatically get buffer overflow protection and so on. So this allows the developers to think more about what they're doing. If they're BGP developers here, they think more about BGP than worry about whether they're properly handling buffer overflows. And so that takes away some of the attack vectors that we typically see in any running system, right? And like I said, the education part of this. So we have internal education that helps the developers understand the different kinds of attacks, and we help the testers also come up with pen testing mechanisms. We have softwares that basically do a lot of fuzz testing and so on. So all of these really help with runtime protection of the system. And of course, we enable things like ASLR so that we can those kinds of attacks are also prevented. So we have ASLR. There's something called OSC, object size checking. We verify that if you are running or copying into some memory, we make sure that you're not exceeding that limit. If you allocated a memory of 10 bytes and you're not writing 12 bytes into that, so all of those would automatically trigger exceptions and prevent the system from going into a bad state. So by using these central mechanisms, we allow the developers to think more about what they need to do for their own features, and centrally we just handle all of the security aspects of the development process and the runtime process as well. So this really helps us a lot in keeping this runtime integrity of the safety of the system intact, right?
So Karthik, I think so. There's a lot of we covered a lot of detail in terms of some of the things we're doing. I think when we often talk to customers about this, there's really a layered defense model that's happening here. The reason the management plane protection works is IP networks have in-band signaling. This is the toughest thing about IP networks is that you're signaling the routing protocols that are the same channel in many cases that you're using to actually carry traffic. So you have to be very careful how you actually protect those interfaces. And that's why we built in these layers of protections against some of these types of attacks on the protocols themselves. There's other attacks, though, that are really more like remote exploits. And these are some of the scary ones, because generally some of the routing protocol attacks are more about denial of service, whereas if you try to do things like remote exploits, that's actually trying to break into the operating system. And this is the stuff that we already know in looking at every other service on the internet is actually very hard to protect against. These are your buffer overflow type attacks. These are all types of remote exploits that can potentially be discovered. And because these routers are sitting outside the firewall, we have to have strong protections against those. And I think one of the things that Karthik can certainly talk more about is protecting against these things is hard. Any potential bug could open you up to a vulnerability that could be remotely exploited. And if that IP interface is open to the outside world, then people could exploit it. Mm. So what would we as a vendor do to do everything we can to limit these types of vulnerabilities? And here, I think what's interesting, just looking at how Cisco deals with this, is we see this as kind of a global problem within Cisco. It's not a question of, did we write secure code for XR for this one protocol daemon? It's more of a holistic thing, saying, how do we have a development process and a set of development libraries that can actually anticipate and block some of these common vulnerabilities?
We've always seen these scenarios where you know, hackers they penetrate into a system, they use an ability to inject their own code, and then using either buffer overflows or an executable stack frame, they're able to change the execution to a different point in the stack, and that to which they have control. Over time, we've blocked all of these mechanisms to the point where you cannot. There are sections of memory that are not executable. We've kind of blocked out a lot of these buffer overflow scenarios and so on. So we're at a point where the kind of attacks that are coming in now, what Dan referred to as return-oriented programming, is an ability to find existing instructions that are already there within the binary of the process. And to be able to manipulate those in order to jump to some particular location which has a malware running in there. So it's getting to the point where it definitely is a lot harder to comprehend, and is also much harder to prevent such attacks from happening. So some things like for instance, the other thing that Dan is talking about is ASLR. ASLR is now enabled pretty much in all of the user space programs that we run. And we're also bringing in ASLR in the kernel space as well. So the address space layout randomization, that's what ASLR stands for. It allows us to randomize the way that the binaries are memory mapped into the system. So there's no fixed address that somebody can go to and say, hi, this is where libc is running, or this is where some particular function is running.
Yeah.
And let me go attack that function.
Okay. Well, we've seen ASLR in Windows and things like that.
Yes, that's correct.
So this is a tried and true proven mechanism for maintaining the security of your device. And as our devices get more and more open, we need to make sure that these things work. Yeah.
And I think the takeaway here, Greg, is writing secure code is hard. It's difficult from a development point of view. So the approach that your vendor takes to actually write secure code matters. So when we talk about some of these things like ASLR or some of these buffer overflow protections, there's a whole set of libraries that we build off of that are actually centrally maintained by a central security group inside of Cisco. The idea here is if we can make a set of safe programming environments to build our features off of, it actually helps us greatly limit the number of exposures because we sort of solve the problem once and create a more secure programming environment.
Right.
As a vendor, what we should be doing to be a good vendor is to solve the problem once and make sure that applies throughout the overall architectures, not just in XR, but also across Cisco. I think that's the other important thing to bring up is that we actually treat security, secure development, and even things like internal pen testing and secure standards, things like the TAM module that we talked about before, are actually centrally built and maintained inside of Cisco. So it's not a product specific thing, but it's really around the idea of how do you solve the problem.
So this is I'm really pleased to hear this in a way, because to move forward in networking, we actually have to bring in best practices in terms of development. And there are this ASLR, these security features that people have been putting into their code have proven to reduce the risk of bad programming. So if somebody makes an error or, somebody does something that they shouldn't, it should be prevented by the operating system or something inside of the code. And that's the sort of thing that we're talking about here.
Yep. Absolutely. And I think the real takeaway here is security is always a moving target. Every time a new exploit is discovered, there's a question of how much work it takes to go back and fix it. The more common code you have, the better it is, because it allows you to fix it once. The thing I'll point you to is crypto development is very hard. Mm. Usually vulnerabilities are not coming from the actual cryptographic algorithms. It's usually from the implementations.
Yes.
So the more standardized we can make these implementations, for instance, the interface into the TAM is a highly cryptographic environment. It's also where we get good entropy in the system from. These are things that are really hard to do well. And if you don't do them well, this is what makes systems very easily exploitable, especially by nation state attackers. Mm. The reason that Cisco has a central security and trust organization to actually set these standards and maintain this technology is to ensure that it's done correctly. The one thing we haven't talked about TAM is that it's also a strong source of entropy. Mm. And you don't really think about this, but
so
this
there's an RNG, there's a random number generator on there. Hardware random number generators are always the best way to go forward because they're better than software random number generators, just for those people who don't know.
Exactly. And the threat here is if you have a bad random number generator, it doesn't matter how well you've implemented a cryptographic protocol. It doesn't matter how good your key management practices are. Every time you generate a key, it's going to be predictable. And this is the thing that in many cases has gone wrong in many implementations out there that are already out there in the internet, whether it's regardless of vendor. There's been multiple examples of where bad entropy has resulted in predictable keys. Mm-hmm. And that gets especially scary when you start thinking about VPN devices. So think about how many times you're regenerating keys as part of key exchange. This is critical. So it's not just the integrity, but it's also creating a good cryptographically secure system with strong entropy and having the software that can take advantage of it. That's if we really look at the big picture, this is what you have to do as a vendor to make a trusted mm-hmm. system.
So I think we're getting to the end of the show. We've been going fairly deep into some fairly esoteric security stuff that many people may not have thought about. And most of these features are a part of the iOS XR, but they are going to be rolled out to the wider Cisco community, if I remember right. Dan, that's correct?
Absolutely. And a lot of this is already in some of the existing products. Yeah. So if we talk about the Trust Anchor module, that's actually something that's common across Cisco that's used in most of the products you're already familiar with.
Most of the current generation of products. It's obviously not something from 10 years ago when it didn't exist, but yes, they're in the modern set of products. Dan, why don't you tell us where we can find more information about the product? Have we got somewhere we can go and look up and get some more details?
Absolutely. So there's actually a great site, especially for technical content about iOS XR that I want to give a shout out to some of my colleagues who have put together just a great site. It's actually called XR Docs. There should be a link in the show notes, but it's xrdocs.github.io, where we're constantly updating this with technical content on XR. And it covers everything from some of the security features to things like ZTP, model-driven telemetry, and some of the other topics you guys have talked about before.
Disaggregation. Yeah. It's actually one of the sites in my RSS feed reader, and I read it quite a bit. I can highly recommend xrdocs.github.io. Lots of really good information for the nerd networking people who want to see the high level. It's not sometimes it gets really down and dirty about Yang, but also sometimes it's very general technical information about a range of things. So I highly recommend that website to you.
Absolutely. And security really is a moving target. There's a constant stream of new capabilities and technologies that are being integrated into iOS XR. So that's a really good place to check in on and see what new is happening. You'll see more security content built out there over time. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, at the time we're taping this, next week we're going to be at the MPLS World Congress. We are actually doing some demonstrations of some new technology we're investigating about being able to measure and report on integrity. So by the time you read this, that should already be happening at MPLS World Congress, and mm-hmm. to look for more information on some of the other integrity measurement reporting work that Cisco is also working on.
Well, hopefully we can get that demo online eventually. I know that's not always something easy to do, but hopefully we can get that up eventually and people can get a look at that, or maybe you can post it as part of your thing. So thanks very much for joining us today, and thanks to Cisco Systems for sponsoring us. Thanks to Dan Backman and Karthik Sivakuma of Cisco for joining us and talking to us about security infrastructure, the whole idea of root of trust and the chain of trust from right the way back in the pre-manufacturing to the the death of the device is something I haven't thought a whole lot about, I must admit. What about you, Ethan?
I have thought about it some just because of Skyport, but when you get into the kinds of compromises that show up, the importance of it is maybe the thing I hadn't thought about quite enough, and the impact and the complexity of it is kind of a big deal.
And also the piece about software integrity, how we're changing their software integrity to make sure that it doesn't do the unexpected, it does the expected, was also quite interesting to me. Well, as always, you can find this and many more fine free technical podcasts, along with our own news and community blog at packetpushers.net. You can always follow us on the social medias. Twitter is at packetpushers. We're on LinkedIn. Just search for packetpushers. Like us on Facebook and rate us on Apple Podcasts. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.